Hey folks, just in case you haven't heard, happening this summer, a revolutionary educational event that you were likely biologically determined to attend. Claim of biological determinism applies only to those who live in New England and have more than the cost of the ticket in their checking account currently. Renegade University and School Sucks Project present A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell.
I'm making a libertarian argument, you fuckers.
Oh boy, it goes down August 5th and 6th in historic, tragicomic Salem, Massachusetts. If you want to learn more or you're ready to pull the trigger and make this happen, go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses. Select A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell. We'll see you there.
On September 30th, 1964, 300 students staged a 12-hour sit-in at Sproul Hall on the Berkeley campus. That was the beginning of the free speech movement. More than a demand for free speech was involved. It has been called a powerful moral drive on the part of the students, a drive born of a determination to restore forsaken standards of human conduct to a cynical society. The free speech fight at the University of California developed simply and logically during the fall of 1964 into a revolt against the machine-like impersonality of the multiversity. It became a cry against the alienation of the individual. It became a demand for the return of the human element to education. The Sproul Hall sit-in was, even its critics will admit, a triumph of organization and discipline.
From the tip of San Diego to the top of Berkeley's hills, we have built a mighty factory to impart our social skills. Social engineering triumph, managers of every kind. Let us all with drills and homework manufacture human minds. Make the students safe for knowledge. Keep them loyal, keep them clean.
Overnight, mayhem on campus. The University of California, Berkeley, erupting in flames as over 1,000 came out to protest an appearance by the self-described right-wing internet troll Milo Yiannopoulos.
We will not tolerate racism or sexism or hate crimes and violence. He's a fascist, and Berkeley did not welcome him.
At least 6 people were injured, including this Trump supporter who was pepper sprayed. The university canceling the speech.
Hey, Milo, we shot you down.
Riot police even retreating to the building for safety. You can hear them urging the crowds to leave.
I think we have a right to say that we don't want him here. And,
The standoff intensifying as protesters lit fireworks, police firing back.
It's going too far right now. This is uncalled for. This is not going to get no message across.
Yiannopoulos, an editor for Breitbart News and an avid supporter of President Trump, responding on Facebook, posting this video.
Because they're so threatened by the idea that a conservative speaker might be persuasive and interesting and funny and might persuade, you know, might take some people with him. They just have to shut it down at all costs.
Today, Nico Satyrakopoulos and I address the question, what exactly happened between those two clips you just heard?
This vulnerable and scared subject comes in the forefront in the 1970s. And of course, then, we also have the oil crisis, with fears about the overpopulation, which back then were considered very credible. And on top of that, you have the environmental narrative.
Yep.
Growing, so you have a perfect storm. Reason is under question. You are a vulnerable individual. The economy is in ruins. The environment is at the tipping point. Population is growing. So you realize that in this situation, you feel threatened. And you feel, oh my God, I'm so helpless. I'm so at the mercy of forces that are beyond me. So if you want to draw a picture kind of in your head, it's a person who feels everything's out of my control. So this is why I think that all these things together create this vulnerable and this weak subject.
Yeah, and suddenly you're a long way from a liberation movement, right?
Yes, and by the and obviously, who is to protect you if you are vulnerable and weak?
The state.
The state.
Hey, how you doing? Sorry I can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you. Hey, how are you doing? Sorry I can't get through. Why don't you leave your name and your number, and I'll get back to you. Once again, it's another rap-handed feeling that I am, I can't stand it. Wanna be down with the day glow, knocking on my door saying, hey, yo, yo. Knocking on my door saying, hey, yo, yo. I got a funky new tune with a fly banjo. I can't understand what the problem is. I find it hard enough dealing with my own biz.
So I'm very pleased to welcome to School Sucks for the first time, Nikos Soterakopoulos. Hi, Nikos.
Hi, Brett.
Nikos is a lecturer in sociology in the Department of Social Science at Loughborough University in England, and he is also the author of The Rise of Lifestyle Activism, From New Left to Occupy. So we're going to get to know each other on the show today. I'm very interested in hearing about your story, your journey, but we are going to start with the book. And what do you mean by lifestyle activism? Because I read that title, I say, that sounds nice.
So the idea, the general idea with the book is that there are all these ideas floating out there. For example, things like, oh, you know, humans are plague on the earth, or money doesn't bring you happiness, mm-hmm. or things like, you know, we've gone too far, we're spending too much, we buy things that we don't need. So the aim of the book is, let's go and trace, where do these ideas come from? And the interesting thing is that although these ideas are not political by themselves, so I come from an Orthodox country and the priest used to say these things when we were at school, but somehow they have got a political meaning. Mm-hmm. So I go back and trace these ideas on a shift that is happening within the left around the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And the reason I call this group of ideas as lifestyle activism is because they're not purely political. So a purely political message would be, I have these ideas about how society should be run. What are the issues with the economy? So I will implement 1, 2, 3. But around these ideas, there are meanings that have mostly to do with our morality, our culture, our taste, how we see the world, how we see people around us. This is why I call it lifestyle. It's not kind of an accusation like, oh, I'm more political in your kind of lifestyle. Although it started this way. I was influenced by Murray Bookchin and his idea of lifestyle anarchism. So Bookchin was kind of a big influence on me. But then I thought anarchism is not enough because it's not any more limited to anarchists. It's limited to wider parts of the left. So I came up with the term lifestyle activism. And I go and trace movements from the 60s, the 70s, the Students for Democratic Society, some environmental movements, then the globalization movement, and I finish with the Occupy movement. And also the case of the left in Greece.
So I heard this term as in reference to individualism, individualist anarchism, basically. And I was always really attracted to the idea that, at least in anarchist terms, it's kind of making a statement with how you live instead of the, I guess, diminutive feeling of political participation. And the idea that I liked was being part of an evolution instead of the dangerous and perhaps even self-sacrificial political revolution. Right. But you're kind of warning here in terms of the left, while it does have the focus on personal impact, it's a lot of feelings, it's a lot of identity politics, and it can even become kind of narcissistic, right?
Yes. So I think a lot of people today have a mistaken view that we live in this individualistic kind of Ayn Randian society.
Yeah, right.
But I think there's a difference. On the one hand, because, you know, of the smartphones, of the social media, you know, of this kind of the thousands of motivational videos on YouTube. Some of them are quite good, by the way. Nothing wrong with them. So on the one hand, we have this idea, I can become whatever I want, which is kind of this, you know, kind of Ayn Randian theme. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have this idea that people are really vulnerable, that once something bad happens to us, it's difficult to get over it. So at the same time, we see ourselves on the one hand, I can do whatever I want with my life, you know, sky is the limit. But at the same time, you know, I am kind of a fragile human being and maybe I need to be protected even from dangerous ideas. The whole discussion about safe space. So it's this kind of contradiction. There's nothing wrong with the politics of the self in terms of, you know, how I lead my life. I make the best out of this life. But at the same time, I'm a bit worried when this turns to what Christopher Lass called the culture of narcissism, that because I feel threatened, I become more and more kind of kept to myself in terms of the politics of me, me, me. For example, you know, Trump won the election, which means that, you know, that was a personal insult to me. Or,
right.
For example, with the whole discussion around Brexit, people were asking, if someone votes for Brexit, you know, you can't do it because this will harm me as a, you know, as a EU citizen. Which is kind of interesting because I don't think this is individualism in terms of, you know, this is empowering. I think this is actually disempowering. I think this takes agency away from the individual.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of like this anti-philosophical individualism. And I don't even want to use the word individualism because it's, I mean, narcissism is a better word. And I think that, you know, there's also the impact of technology. I remember having a MySpace page, like first setting up a MySpace page and being able to post my opinions on it and thinking I was some kind of star, you know? And like these are the songs. I mean, there is this kind of self-aggrandizement about it that has now spiraled way more out of control. And once you get a modest following, people are convinced that pretty much everything they have to say is really, really important, especially people who are so young that they've never lived in a world where, you know, Web 2.0 didn't exist. So I'm seeing this as a confluence of factors that produce kind of an ugly situation in the present. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think it all boils down to, you know, to the general ideas that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, have you noticed how I was thinking of the other day of the film Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
This film, like 15 years ago, every proper leftist loved this film. But have you noticed how today a lot of people who identify with the alt-right, we like this film?
Mm-hmm.
Because like, oh, you know, everything is so artificial today. Everything is so materialistic. And, you know, what about this kind of masculine identity? So when you have ideas who are just floating out there, everyone can, in a way, appropriate them. And if you don't have kind of proper, very stable premises, which is something that the old left did have, so no matter whether you like or not the old left, they had, it was quite difficult to say, you know, that they had something, some very specific premises, no matter whether you like them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas today, it seems like everything is kind of floating. You can get the one message and appropriate it in a kind of a progressive way. And then 10 years later, the same message is appropriated, let's say, by the alt-right or by someone who is very conservative or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about your transition from the left, because that was where you started. And was it realizations like those that, you know, started your move, or how did that happen for you?
Actually, the starting point might sound very, very awkward, but I came to this country something like 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it was the time when the smoking ban was introduced in the pubs.
Mm-hmm.
I never used to smoke a lot, but, you know, I enjoy the occasional cigarette. And it was the first thing that, so I was very statist up to this point, although I still believed in this idea that, you know, space communism, technology. I was for all these things. But at the same time, I was more on the statist side. So then I started thinking, wait a minute, why is it that the pub owner, so the pub owner wants people to smoke in their pub. I want to smoke in their pub. So it's kind of weird that someone says, no, you're not allowed to do this. So this was the first kind of thing that triggered some thought in my head. And then for a lot of years, I consider myself within the milieu of what we call Marxist humanism,
mm-hmm.
which is basically libertarianism in everything except from economics. But then I was reading Capital, so I was very much into the economic stuff of Marx. but I had some questions that I couldn't find the answers within Marx, the most obvious being the labor theory of value. And then I came to the subjective theory of value and some readings of the Austrian school, and I said, this is also an interesting kind of milieu. Let's see what's happening there. And through that, I came into contact with more ideas around free society or around the anarchism. So at the moment, I would say that although my basic ideas haven't changed, I realize that what I'm looking for is not anymore there in the left. Perhaps it was never there and it was just me, but, you know, I'm not.
So
this is kind of my journey, let's say.
Yeah, and a big part of that was letting go of the Marxist economic ideas, which
yes.
is an interesting transition to my next question, because there really is this distinction between what is referred to as the old left and what you call and what people have called, I guess, since the early 70s, including Ayn Rand, the new left. It seems like the transition from one to the other was really affected or created by some of the obvious failures of Marxism in economics. So I think more the old left as the scientific managers, the kinds of people that John Taylor Gatto warns about, you know, these sort of socialist central planners who wanted to use the schools to help create a mold for their ideal vision of society or a mold for the people that could carry that out.
Yes.
In the 60s and 70s, the emergence of the new left is really more a creature of postmodernist ideas catching on in the United States. Would you say that's correct? And what would you add to that?
Shall I first give my general idea about what is happening with kind of this shift?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a danger here. So there's two things that are happening. For example, you see today the left has made this boogeyman of neoliberalism. So basically whatever they don't like is neoliberalism, which is never identified and it's never something specific. I think there's a danger, and myself sometimes is falling into this trap, and I think up to some point I'm also doing it a bit on the book. We get these things like, you know, Frankfurt School or postmodernism as something which is one thing. And we kind of project there whatever we don't like. So I would say that, yes. So let's say, for example, let's start with Frankfurt School. Okay. They had a lot of influence in these chains. And as you said, they realize that socialism is not any more defensible in terms of material standards. Okay. It has lost the battle in terms of what is the system that delivers the goods.
Mm-hmm.
But what you will notice is that some of their ideas, such as, you know, there's a problem with mass society, that consumerism is alienating us, that all this conformity in art, Adorno was saying it's a problem that you can find the poster, for example, of Gioconda for a very cheap price in the convenience store. So, but all these ideas are not really new. These are conservative ideas that are repackaged in a different cover, so to speak. And for example, Foucault, who I know a lot of people believe he's kind of the worst postmodernist, actually he's a very interesting thinker. He gives some parts of some text by some prominent fascist theorists, and if you read them, like if you play a pub quiz, who told it? Mm-hmm. This fascist theorist or Frankfurt School? They're similar. And of course, I'm not saying that Frankfurt School is morally reprehensible as a fascist. What I'm saying is some of their themes, like the themes against mass society, the things against, oh, we're so individualized and somehow this is a problem, which, by the way, these are contradictory. So I never understood how they can kind of fall on the same, they can be under the same umbrella. So these people bring back some older conservative ideas, but now they give them kind of a progressive edge.
Mm-hmm.
And they're indeed very prominent. So, for example, when I went to school in Greece in the early 90s, in school, it was the time where the progressive government has been around for like 10 years. And in school, we came back again and again to the same themes, like, you know, this society is so alienating, like building blocks are the boxes of the soul, something, things like that. So they really had an influence. Now, Are they still influential today? That's another topic. But the main theme is that, one, yes, indeed, the Frankfurt School in a way is moving the goalposts. Capitalism is not anymore bad as because it does not deliver the goods or because of immiseration. It is bad because it alienates us. So it's bad mostly for reason that has to do with our psyche or with the culture. So this is the one thing. The second thing is that is convenient because that is exactly the time when the old left is more and more is losing kind of its moral advantage, not only on the economic sphere, but also on the moral thing. So in 56, you have the Warsaw Pact invading Hungary. You have Khrushchev delivering that speech about Stalin. So in these are the years where a lot of leftists don't really feel at home in the old left. And now you have this new narrative that is available to them. So everyone is jumping on the bandwagon because, you know, it's a win-win. You can still stay within the left and you still have something to complain about the system. So it's kind of convenient.
Mm. So I realized, and I said this in my last show, I was talking to an academic named Thaddeus Russell, and he observed that I'm kind of conspiratorial. I'm real into, Nikos, uncovering monolithic plots against me whenever possible. So there's an allure around this whole story, right? That, and you're speaking to this a little bit, that the arguments for socialism were originally scientific. When the, you know, post-Russian Revolution in the 1920s, it was technocrats who were basically, you know, bringing about this system. And then with Stalin, it got very ugly. When we're talking too about socialism coming into the United States and being embraced, getting a widespread embrace in the United States and why it doesn't happen. Certainly, you know, the second Red Scare and McCarthyism are not helpful. And, you know, so my understanding was that the people who wanted to bring about the Marxist Revolution realized that it was not going to happen in the United States. And around this time, and it wasn't just at this time, I mean, you mentioned 1956, but you could probably trace the story back to the 20s. They were also realizing that the scientific arguments, in addition to the moral arguments, are falling apart. So this isn't going to be delivered, through that kind of a dialogue, and it needs to be repackaged as something else. Now, that, to me, is maybe too conspiratorial, and I want to make sure I'm not being kind of hysterical about it. When I first saw the Frankfurt School, I was like, this is so exciting. You know, this is as good as the Prussian schools being brought into the United States. So, yeah, go ahead.
So here's an argument that in a way dismisses the, you know, this was kind of a project. Mm-hmm. By the way, there's a very good book by someone called Stephen Hicks.
Yeah.
Who writes a book about postmodern, and his claim is, it's a claim that is, you know, it has some merit. It says, isn't it weird that all these thinkers are more or less towards the same side in terms of politics? So maybe there's something there. But I would say, look at it this way. If you read Atlas Shrugged, written in the 50s and the 40s, and started in the 40s, finished in the 50s, or The Fountainhead, what I find most exciting in Ayn Rand's books are not the heroes. The heroes are great. But the most interesting thing is the evil people, the villains. And there are some parts, some things that they say, which is, you would say, how could she predict? This is like the postmodernist narrative. How could she predict that? People like saying, and how do you know this is true? And who says this is true? Or the most interesting thing in Atlas Shrugged is someone that says, you know, we need to produce this organic kind of soil. And this is in the 50s. So two things could be happening. The one thing is that somehow Ayn Rand could see the future, which mm-hmm. I don't think it's the case. Or she could already sense within culture these trends. So I think, again, these trends were already there, not only in leftist circles, but also in conservative circles. And again, it was kind of convenient. And make no mistake, this is not just a leftist project. For example, see environmentalism, okay? The right was quite quick to also jump philosophically up to a point in the bandwagon. Okay, first Earth Day with Nixon and all that stuff.
Right.
So I'm not really convinced that this is kind of a pro. So some people gather together and they say, okay, we're losing the game. What are we doing? And sometimes this is instinctive. When you see that, okay, this argument doesn't work, maybe you persuade yourself that, okay, but here's a better argument. That's how I see it.
Well, I think that's interesting too. I mean, you mentioned Nixon, who, you know, had many kind of left leaning impulses as early as the late 60s. And, you know, I've heard Tom Woods talk about how this infected everything. You know, this Frankfurt School scholarship, once it came to, or, you know, postmodernism generally, and not to conflate the two, but everybody was affected by, you know, the work of people like Marcuse, who went after not just academia, but, you know, the media and the entertainment industry. You could see that. But I think one of the big and just to go back to Rand for a minute, she wrote a book in the early 70s called The New Left. I think originally it might have
been. Yeah, it's two editions. The one is, I think, The Return of the Primitive. The other is The Anti-Industrial Revolution. So, yes. See, and that's a good book in terms of philosophically kind of spotting these trends.
It sounded like she was saying, I've only read parts of it, but it was basically like, hey, I'm kind of worried about these college students today. And it's interesting that those people that she was worried about stuck around. Many of them today are academics, you know, in those same institutions. And, you know, part of what increased my concern about this is I read a lot of Rand years ago. I saw her warnings about this thing at the time. I didn't even know what it was. You know, I didn't fully understand what she was talking about because, you know, I was really more attracted to her anti-fascism, anti-Nazism, anti-collectivism messages, yeah, generally, anti-Soviet Union. And I kind of missed the boat on changes that she was seeing in the 1960s and the 1970s. But she knew then she was worried about students. Those students became professors. Those professors are teaching, you know, a new generation of students that have all kinds of additional generational, societal and technological challenges. And I'm worried about where it goes from there, right? Because I think the problem that Rand was describing in the early 70s got worse in the two generations that followed. And, yeah, I'm kind of worried about where it goes next.
So again, I don't think that people are somehow conscious that, you know, there are these ideas that we need to suppress and there's these ideas that we need to put forward. Most mm-hmm. people just want to go their own way, you know, finish work, go to home, have good relations with other colleagues. So the fanatics are really a tiny minority. I think, again, an easier way to see it is that these ideas are so mainstream that they're kind of the default ideas.
Yeah.
So it's, you don't really need a master plan in order to have these ideas dominating academia. Because these ideas are kind of, you could even link them to, let's say, again, with conservative ideas. So again, the idea of, you know, don't be materialistic, that the idea of profit is something which is problematic, or the idea that, you know, public education, which is obviously your kind of thing, that how can there be any other system than public education? So these ideas are default within the left, but also within the right. And of course, now the right has, some people have understood that, okay, there's something here. We can oppose this and kind of appear as radical, or this is kind of a way to differentiate our product. And this is why you have sometimes what I would say reverse virtue signaling. Like, you know, I just gonna poke these people all the time, you know, social justice warriors. But I don't really think it is annoying. This group thinking specifically within the academy, it is annoying, specifically if you don't agree with these things. But I don't think it's something conscious. I think it happens kind of by default, because these ideas are so popular right out there. And again, I'll give you the example of Greece. The thing that the left is saying are not really different from the things that the priest was saying in church. And they both embrace that. The proper kind of old leftist communist in Greek would say, yes, we are kind of like the old Christians. And there was a time in the 50s, when political repression was very harsh, when a prominent communist was executed, kind of the head of the Greek church, although he was the ideological rival, he said, you know, their sacrifice reminds me of all of the proto-Christians. So there was always this kind of, there is something that we both understand here. That, and again, today, this can, you can see these things also in parts of the new right, or the new right, or the alt-right, or whatever. So I don't think that they're also part of this conspiracy.
That's really interesting.
Their, if you see their websites, they're even talking about, they're even using the same terms, like critical thinking, critical theory, critical race theory. So even the kind of the jargon is kind of similar. I know you had an episode some weeks ago on that, on this topic about identity and the alt-right, which I think was actually interesting.
It's interesting because it sounds like what you're describing is a phenomenon that's part impulse and part insularity. Jonathan Haidt, the moral psychologist, has talked about this. And, you know, let's forget liberal versus leftist versus conservative and just talk like leftist versus libertarian. I mean, can you imagine the ratio, the disproportion, the ratio of leftists to libertarians? So there's that insularity there, but this impulse, and it's interesting. I was just talking to Thaddeus Russell about conformism among academics. And, you know, he started talking about residual effects of Christianity, black and white, good and evil kind of duality. So it's interesting that you're bringing that up as well.
Well, again, the thing is, these people, I think, are 100% persuaded that their view is the proper one. So they don't see themselves as, oh, I'm oppressing someone, or I'm creating this anti-intellectual environment. I think they genuinely believe these things. They genuinely believe that the best thing for you know, the utilitarian argument, the best society can only come through our way. So I, specifically, if you know, if you believe this thing within yourself, you don't really need the master plan to kind of have these ideas spreading. So, but again, I don't know.
It's interesting. Maybe it's even part laziness. You know, when you start to look into the nihilistic qualities of a lot of, not just postmodernism generally, or critical theory, or some of the ideas that these Frankfurt School guys push. They seem like pretty morose and depressive characters. And maybe there's just something that's attractive on more of an emotional level there, since so much of this seems to be emotion over reason anyway. There's just a natural appeal this has.
True, but just to play devil's advocate, like the biographical elements of these people, you know, they face persecution, they have to fly from Germany. Mm-hmm. So the idea is they try somehow to explain the Holocaust. Like, how did this monstrosity happen? And this, so Adorno has a very famous line, something like, there cannot ever be again poetry after Holocaust. So they try to find how could this monstrosity happen? And I think they give the wrong explanation. So they blame. So basically, they think that if you take enlightenment kind of and the idea of modernity to its logical conclusion, it's Auschwitz. But like, I think it's the exact opposite. Like, you know, enlightenment is about reason. Nazis was about faith, faith in the leader, faith in the destiny, whatever. Enlightenment is about the individual. They are about the collective. So I cannot really see how they could draw this line between modernity and the concentration camp, but they did. But kind of just to give them, not a point, but I think that's the explanation, that they lived in bleak times, mm-hmm. and they tried to somehow explain them. And also, they thought that the worst was probably ahead, because this was the time of the Cold War, the idea that a nuclear disaster could happen. So in their heads, what was happening is that the unbelievable happened with the Holocaust, and something worse might be ahead. So what on earth is happening here? How horrible everything is. So yes, there are kind of giving a depressing message, but also I think it's because they view it through this idea that we are heading towards a road which is paved with probably even worse disaster.
That's interesting. These had to be, you know, mostly with Jewish backgrounds, fairly traumatized individuals, you know, leaving the situation they were leaving in the mid-1930s. And I've even read...
But then again, for example, Mises also had to leave Austria, but he was a bit more optimist. So it also has to do with what are your views and your ideas generally, I guess. It's because a lot of people who had to flee and were persecuted, or they had relatives in the Holocaust, they had the more positive or optimist kind of message or the existentialist. For example, Sartre is saying that even in the concentration camp, you still have, you know, the space to be free and to take your decision. So,
interesting. So let's depart from the Frankfurt School guys for a minute and go back to some territory we already covered, which was the New Left, and try to understand this a little bit better. So this is a movement that begins in the early 1960s, and initially, and I wonder if there's also like residual effects of this, why people still think these movements are positive or attractive despite some of the, you know, the hardships and horrors they've caused economically and socially in the United States over the last, you know, 50 or 60 years. But they started as movements for liberation in yeah. most respects in the United States in the 1960s. And we could argue that they were poisoned by bad philosophy and they became anti-freedom ultimately. But how did the New Left first start to show up in the United States in ways that were initially positive? I mean, this is true with any movement, right? Like, nobody ever says, look at all of the horrible shit. Wait till you see what we do. It's going to be crazy. No one ever says that. Everything starts, you know, positively. Freedom is a word that is pushed out in front of most movements, human freedom and liberation from something, including Marxism. So what did it look like initially? And how does this collision happen that starts to change New Left movements?
So if you think about it, there's also something distinctive American in a good way in the very early stage. For example, the Jack Kerouac idea. We hit the road. Mm. Everything is open in front of us. We're not bound by any, you know, cultural barriers. We break the barriers. We test the barriers. We test the culture. So there's this idea of, you know, I have in my head now that song, you know, the Born to be Wild, I'm on the, you know.
Right.
All this is good stuff. So it starts, there's also this cultural element, and also it's the political element. So the political element has to do with Berkeley, the free speech movement, mm-hmm. which ironically, some days ago, I saw some people burning a sign that said free speech in Berkeley, which was a reference to the yep. movement back then.
Right.
There's also the whole anti-imperialist kind of theme. So you have at this time the war in Vietnam, more and more people start questioning the warfare, welfare, mostly the warfare state. And let's remember that these were the times that people could still be drafted. Mm. So you're a male student, the possibility that you're drafted to Vietnam is very real. So these things, so on the one hand, the cultural element that you start pushing kind of the bourgeois, as they call them, ethics, as much as you could, you test them. And they couldn't hold strong because the conservative culture at that time was in retreat. So ideas, for example, like patriotism or nationalism or in Europe, imperialism, or even ideas that had some legitimacy like racial superiority were completely discredited. Mm-hmm. So there was no, and some of these ideas should be discredited. Others, for example, hierarchy in terms, for example, that the lecturer knows better than the student. So there are some merits in some of these ideas, but the idea was question everything. And this coincided with the political part, with the anti-Vietnam mobilization. Some years earlier, we had the civil rights movement. So there were people who had experience in civil disobedience. Again, civil disobedience has roots within the American culture, Henry David Thoreau and all that. Mm-hmm. So all this created a mix. And also you have people like Rothbard jumping on this bandwagon because sure. they look around and there's nothing politically. There's no, and this is something new. So the idea is the field is open, the narrative is open. Let's jump there and see if we can change it or if we can influence it, or let's see where it goes. So at that point, it was an open movement. It was for very kind of progressive causes. May 68, for example, in Paris started because some students wanted, it was against the idea that you have specific dorms for male and for female students. So it was again, the culture, it was the one that triggered the whole event. So this is how it starts, but because it is quickly dominated by mostly, I would not say old or new left. I would say confused leftist messages. Mm-hmm. So you'd have like Maoists, Trotskyists, Leninists, anarchists, situationists. It doesn't really go anywhere specific. So quickly it dissolves to adventurism or to subjectivism or to, you know, let's go and experiment in our commune. And the failure brings a disillusionment. And this disillusionment is the idea that there was all this energy and still we did not manage to change the world out there. And because we cannot change the world out there, what we can do is change ourselves. So then you have this retreat to the self, you know, all these, I would call them, you know, new age experimentations, the communes, the spirituality.
Parenting, so these, even the family.
Element, sorry?
Even the family, like Spock, I think, was influenced by Eric Fromm.
Yeah. Eric, so you had a lot of communes with experiment with polyamory, with group parenting, all sorts of experimentations. But I see these things as a result of what these people perceived as a defeat. And of course they were defeated because they didn't have very tangible objects, targets. But the whole idea was, you know, the system has not changed. So I guess there's nothing we can do. So let's influence the things that we can actually change, which is things on the micro level.
You know, I'm thinking of what I know about that time period and phrases that sound great, like make love, not war, which I think was actually credited to Herbert Marcuse.
All right, I didn't know that. Yeah.
When you hear a phrase like that, you say, well, hell yeah, of course. That doesn't even seem like it needs to be unpacked. Yes. But then it becomes a question like why? Like there is an important question to be out there, like why make love, not war? Why are you telling people that? And, you know, it seems like when you talk about a lot of these, I think it was also Marcuse who talked about this polymorphously perverse, open sexuality, these things that, you know, all the way back in the 1930s, when they were happening to some degree in the Weimar Republic, were referred to as degeneracy. And, you know, we connect the word degeneracy to like, oh, those people are degenerates, but it meant like they are degenerating society. Like society will not continue if this behavior does. Civilization mm-hmm. will eventually collapse if this takes hold and becomes widespread. And I think that might have been, as much as I want people to have, you know, as much freedom to do whatever they want, as long as it's not at anyone else's expense or to anyone else's peril, there is a threat in some of these behaviors if they become widespread enough. So while make love, not war is an attractive catchphrase, and obviously in its simplest form, I totally agree with it, you know, there's been accusations leveled at a lot of these thinkers. Go back all the way pre-Frankfurt School to people like Antonio Gramsci, that the conditions for the Marxist revolution require basically, you know, the dissolution of society as it is. And if it needs to be undermined with, you know, libertinism or Pleasure Island type stuff, that's how it will be done. So I've been holding on to this idea as well, and this is part of what's informed my more conspiratorial thinking, that people like Gramsci or Georg Lukács, I think his name Lukács was his name, actually said you need to turn over society if you want to have this socialist revolution by any means necessary. So yeah, go ahead.
So if you see cases like France or Italy, where you have a very strong orthodox, so to speak, communist party or left party, they are the most feared opponents of these trends. Mm-hmm. So specifically in Italy, you have physical clashes between communist party militias and the new left. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, maybe some people would see this as a revolt against what they consider bourgeois ethics. On the other hand, the people who were most horrified with this were the people who could objectively bring on the revolution. Because the communist parties back then, they were very powerful. They controlled huge parts of the working class, huge levels of organization. So they were the ones who could actually bring turmoil. And they are the most horrified with these, with these trends. So I'd say this is the one thing. So I don't think that the left is unanimously seeing this as, oh yeah, that's, then we have an open road kind of to overturn society. And the other thing I would say is that this experimentation is, again, it's also a reaction that gets a momentum of its own. So it's a reaction for the sake of reaction. And you can see this in the Berkeley free speech movement. It starts as an idea. We want to be free to have a stall and propagate our views. And it turns to, I don't remember what was the name of the guy who was constantly cursing or writing obscene things, because the idea was, I want to provoke.
Mm-hmm.
But again, was this, let's say, a recipe for social change or a recipe for revolution? I don't think so. I think that just people were just doing their thing, kind of, you know, following the whim, following the fashion. And I don't think that on the back of their head, there's any, even a plan about a revolution. And again, you could see that in May 68, the country's in turmoil. But I don't think there was any moment that specific, at least the new left, had any idea about, oh, we could do, you know, we could take control, or our time has come. I don't think there has been any such moment. So, not to mention today. Today, there's not even any difference. So today, I would say that politically or in economic terms, the left and the kind of Keynesian social democracy are one. But even at that time, when you could say the new left was something which is identifiable and it had kind of also a significant amount of people, they did not aspire to bring such a colossal change as overturning a moral or an economic system.
So a person can stay on the tracks better in their research of this thing if they focus on the philosophical and the psychological versus the conspiratorial.
Also they were significantly unable to do even the basic things. I mean, if you read details about Woodstock, it's so weird. At some point, they've run out of food, they've run out of water, so they're like helicopters throwing kind of food and water, because otherwise these people are in a situation where they cannot even manage the very basic. Mm-hmm. So you have this moment, which is supposedly kind of the all the energy is unleashed, but at the same time, at that moment, you need the bourgeois state and, I don't know, the army or whatever to throw you food like parachuting boxes, otherwise you'll starve. So it kind of shows what were actually the limits.
Don't you talk about in your book that one of the problems with this set of ideas is that it creates weak people, you know?
Yes.
And I think that would be the phenomenon that you're describing would certainly be the result of, you know, the embrace of something that isn't healthy, that doesn't promote self-efficacy or self-sufficiency. And, you know, people choosing, God, I feel like such a conservative criticizing this sometimes, like pleasure over responsibility. And I had some, I wouldn't call them debates, but I had some discussions with a couple of friends who were sympathetic to many aspects of the social justice movement and, you know, in their own lives have embraced things like, you know, polyamory and the philosophy of hedonism. And I think those things are workable for individuals who are also willing to work on themselves, you know, in real serious ways to basically be psychologically and physically and I guess in vocationally self-sufficient. But when you combine all of these temptations with people who haven't done that work, it seems to produce a very dangerous world, which even if it's a minority, which I think is what we saw a lot of in the 1960s, where things were very much off the rails philosophically, but we also saw this increase in helplessness. And maybe that's just a byproduct of embracing left-wing economic ideas generally. As time goes on, people do seem to weaken, you know? We're seeing a lot of that right now, like in Scandinavia, the countries that were these socialist paradises that are now collapsing – largely around the inability to solve certain problems. So I don't. Maybe I'm rolling too much together there, but I do see what you're talking about in the 1960s as a predictable outgrowth of the embrace of these ideas. And maybe you could just relate to how you explain that in the book a little bit, the weakening.
Yeah, so the message is, again, where to start, but you could say that the message is, look, if we are vulnerable, let's say, to consumerism or to mass society, and if basically we are victims of... No, I'd start differently. If reason is not a thing, okay, or if reason leads to horrible stuff, as we saw on Second World War, that's what Frankfurtians would say.
Right.
Then, to begin with, you haven't got a compass. You haven't got a GPS, let's say, to lead your life. If you haven't got a GPS to be led in your life, then you are, let's say, vulnerable to accidents and to fate. So then you need something else. And what is this something else that can come in this place? Faith, the group, our small commune, or whatever. So you try to find meaning in these communities. Mm-hmm. Nisbet talk about the quest for community, the quest for meaning. But actually, this is what's happening. So in a way, these people, they feel alienated. They're constantly told that they're alienated. Like, yes, of course you feel alienated. Don't you know that reason, you know, is not an absolute? Don't you know that this is an alienating society? So they are bombarded with these ideas. So in a way, they embrace them. And like, yes, indeed. So what is my way out? My way out could be, again, spirituality. These things that do not expect me to take initiative in terms of, I know that this is this and I will do that. And that's why you have this image of this kind of weak, vulnerable individual. And again, the best explanation of this trend beside Ayn Rand is, again, Christopher Lass in his book, The Culture of Narcissism. He explains how this vulnerable and scared subject comes in the forefront in the 1970s. And of course, then we also have the oil crisis. We have the ridiculous fears about the overpopulation, which back then were considered very credible.
Mm.
And on top of that, you have the environmental narrative growing. So you have a perfect storm. Reason is under questioning. You are a vulnerable individual. The economy is in ruins. The environment is at the tipping point. Population is growing. So you realize that in this situation, you feel threatened and you feel, oh my God, I'm so helpless. I'm so at the mercy of forces that are beyond me. So if you want to draw a picture kind of in your head, it's a person who feels everything's out of my control. So this is why I think that this kind of all these things together create this vulnerable and this weak subject.
Yeah, and suddenly you're a long way from a liberation movement, right?
Yes, and by the and obviously, who is to protect you if you are vulnerable and weak?
The state.
The state, exactly.
Right. Wow, that explains a lot. And now we're just seeing basically an accelerated version of that today in this country. I'm really surprised how fast so many of these social justice issues, like if you just ask a couple of the right questions, you get to an economic issue. You get to an issue of expanding state power. I don't know if you've noticed that as well. Somebody, I guess to antagonize me, sent me a blog called 10 Things an Intersectional Feminist Should Ask on a First Date.
I've seen it.
All right. So this is making the rounds. And, you know, I was reading it and I'm saying, gosh, I could have done without seeing this today. This is just agitating me pretty much. You know, concepts like decentering your whiteness, your maleness. And so you have these social things. But as you read through the list, oh, boy, suddenly you get this transition to anti-capitalism or just economic remedies, pro-state expansion-related remedies. So that always seems to be what underlies this. And I think that generates a lot of the suspicion that, you know, the modern social justice movement, PC movement, has this very strong undercurrent that is still very much about a socialist revolution in this country. What do you think?
Well, yes. And what is the main problem? That today, most people, and this indeed starts in the universities, the term social is kind of equated with the state. So mm-hmm. a social problem is a problem where the state needs to intervene and give a solution.
Social program. So,
yes, a social program. Yeah, because I don't remember, that's not my idea, but I found a great idea. Someone said, see these terms like justice, program, progress, whatever. If you put social in front, social justice, so suddenly they become this kind of, oh my God, I don't want anything to do with that. Because most, a lot of people realize, oh, this is kind of, again, this kind of propaganda, which is not very helpful. So I think, but again, it has to do with the idea that people feel that we cannot really bring change. The idea is all the big visions of the past have led either to gulags or to the Holocaust. Yeah. So, you know, what can we do? The best we can hope for is kind of the state intervening and somehow, you know, doing a bit of here, a bit of there. And yeah, maybe in between you will lose kind of freedoms, or, you know, your pub is not anymore your pub because I say you cannot smoke there. But that's, you know, it's a fair price to pay. So I think this is the problem. People cannot even imagine solving these problems beyond kind of the idea of the guy with the bullhorn, as Tom Wood says,
yeah,
jumps in and kind of solves it.
What would your recommendation to be after doing all of this research on this topic and, you know, basically coming right up to the present day? What would your advice be for the young people who, you know, are especially coming out of public school, are particularly vulnerable to these ideas, especially in higher education environments? Have you tried to do any outreach? And if so, what would it be if you could?
So the interesting thing is that, and again, I guess I'm lucky because I'm in a university that gives me a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. So whenever I teach things like, you know, why globalization is good, or yesterday I had a class on Nozick and his idea of justice, students are like, oh yeah, that's interesting. And whenever you give them kind of a positive vision about the future, so when you told them, for example, that, you know what, actually the environment in which we live is way more livable than it used to be 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember going to Edinburgh in a city tour, and the guy who was doing the tour said, if I put you in a time capsule and I throw you back in 200 years, the moment you come out of the capsule, you'd immediately faint because you would not be able to endure the smell. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And whenever you tell them, look, all these things are going fine, you know, we're doing better. Of course, there are a lot of problems, injustices, yes, sure, all that stuff. But the big picture is technology is liberating, technology is changing things for the better. They immediately, like, ah, that's interesting. So even if, you know, they've grown up in school or whatever, with all bombarded about all these pessimist, kind of dark, gloomy ideas, they're quite open. And of course, you see things out there. I think Uber can change so many people's minds, probably even more than 100 books. A ride with Uber, when you realize I cooperate with the Uber driver and no one has a moral say on what we do. I say, will you give me a ride? Yes, I do. We shake hands, that's it. So, and more people start seeing it because they're using these things. Or they're using things like, you know, Airbnb, which I think the sharing economy is so brilliant. It's the thing that made me see, yes, if you really are a progressive, you know, more control on the hands of workers, that's the big thing. You literally own the means of production with 3D printing, for example. So these are the positive things. These are the big things. Most people are never going to read Nozick. They're never going to read the... Even from the leftist literature, like Trotsky has some amazing kind of positive stuff. Like people will be kind of in a semi kind of Superman level, not in a Nietzschean way, but, you know, everything is possible. They're not going to read that stuff. But when they see stuff out there, when they see the fantastic things that are happening, I think this is the kind of the thing that changes people's minds and can change people's ideas.
So making explicit for them and really almost being a model of appreciation for these things is really important. It's a doom and gloom world. And, you know, all my news feeds do is give me this horizontal, vast view of doom. You know, it's like somebody sent me that article, you know, that why I'm not learning anything from that, even though it did contribute to our discussion, the 10 things to ask on a date. But remaining positive and focusing on the positive, and as new agey as that might sound, it still is good advice. These people weren't, all wrong about everything. So yeah,
no, indeed.
I appreciate that. Okay, Nikos, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope we can have you back because
thank you for having me.
We could dig way further into this at some point in the future. So I enjoyed the conversation, and I want to give you a chance to just plug anything that you have, including the book and where people can find you on the web or on Twitter.
Can I just say one thing about the book?
Yeah, sure.
I was in another show some time ago, and a lot of people emailed me almost angry, and they said, I liked you in your show. I went to Amazon to get your book, and it's so expensive. Like, who do you think you are? Just to let people know, a writer has no control whatsoever on the publishing process. So before you even write the book, you sign a contract. And specifically, if you want to work in a university, you have to go with an academic publisher. The academic publisher will put up a ridiculous price, and I have nothing to do with it. So whenever you have someone who has written an academic book, don't blame the author. He has nothing to do with the high price. Although I've been told that the book is out as a PDF in some quasi-legal sites. I don't know, but yeah.
So the book is The Rise of Lifestyle Activism from New Left to Occupy. Your Twitter is at Nikos_17.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
That was good fun. Thank you.